glad that you could join us once again tonight. I see the chat room is filling up. We're going to have the phone lines lit up. We have a fantastic show for you this evening. I am introducing Peter Canova. He's a wonderful author of the subject for this evening, the book called Pope Annalisa. And when we get into the subject matter, you're going to be just blown away. This is a fantastic novel. It's a novel that I couldn't put down. I actually read it within a few days, and it's a thick one. And it is just riveting. Every moment, every page is just incredible. But I'd like to bring forth our guest. I'm just going to spend all of our time, because you know time is precious here, but we want to take every moment in bringing this gentleman here and helping you to get to know him and his brilliance. Welcome to Illuminations Radio, Peter.
Hi, Tamara. Nice to be with you tonight.
Hi. So glad you could take time out to be with us to just talk about this fantastic book. But first, as always, I'd like to introduce you to the family and everyone to get a feel of who you are and what motivated you, what brought you here. Because as we know, each and every moment in our lives brings us to that one culminating moment. And I think right here and right now is that moment for us. I mean, this is a moment that's never to be repeated. It's never existed before. So right now is the most important moment in time. So tell us your story and what led you to this great work of Pope Annalisa.
Well, that's a long story that I'll try and make as short as I can for the sake of the listeners. I guess you could say that when I was in my teen years, I was one of those people that always felt there was something a little bit either wrong with me or wrong with the world, but something just didn't seem like it was in its right place. And it's not uncommon for teenagers to feel alienation. Maybe the difference between me and the average teenager was that I obsessed over these issues, and it led me on probably a spiritual search, looking for some deeper answers to things. I guess my mind was always thinking in those directions. And then by the time I was in my early 20s, an advertisement in a newspaper caught my eye, and it was for a program called Silva Mind Control. And this was back in, I'll be dating myself now, but this was back in the 70s. And this was, although the name sounds kind of ominous, this was a very well-known program back then. And its purpose was really to cultivate our intuition at what they would have called back in those days extrasensory perception. And this really kind of had an appeal to me because, you know, I felt, well, you know, maybe there's going to be some answers in this. And I went through the course, and I went through it for about a week or so. And the final day, we did a very kind of interesting experiment, which was they would bring us in index cards that would have the name, age, and address, and some medical information about the person on the card. Now, these cards were brought in by the various students that had gone through the course, and they had a lot of people that went through that course back in the 70s, so they had a pretty big resource file. And what we would have, we would break off in pairs, and two of us would sit in the corner. One person would have the card, and they would just simply tell you the person's name, age, and address, and they'd say, well, what can you tell me? What information do you have? So I remember very clearly the first case I did. It was an elderly gentleman down in Miami, and I sort of had an image of him in my mind, and my sense was attracted immediately, my attention was attracted immediately to the area of the heart. And it looked like his heart was tilted at a funny angle, and it was causing the aorta to be pinched off, and that indicated to me a blockage in the aorta, and that's what I said. And they said, that's correct, we have that information here. And then I saw something metallic down the bottom quadrant of the heart, and I said, I think he's had some device like a pacemaker installed there. And they said, that's correct, he has a pacemaker. And they asked, what year was the pacemaker installed? So I saw the hands of a clock moving around very rapidly, and it stopped at 10 o'clock, which in my mind indicated 10 years earlier. Now, this was 1975, so I said, well, I believe the pacemaker was put in 1965, and that was, sure enough, the information on the card. So I then proceeded to do quite a few other of these cases, not just in the class, but I actually started doing cases for people who would. I was a student in those days in a working class neighborhood in Boston. I had people lining up outside my doors because, you know, the word was getting around that there's some weird guy that does these medical readings over there. So, you know, it's like the more you did it, the more the information came through. But to make a long story short, the awakening for me was that. I remember I went home that night and I probably slept more peacefully than I have at any time in my life because I just went home with this feeling of a unity of all things because I was saying to myself, how can I possibly know this information in such detail about somebody else and what was going on with them physically, mentally, you know, in such detail if we weren't all connected at an unseen level, if we weren't connected by something larger than ourselves, of which we're all a part, and which we share information and valuable information that can help with the betterment of our lives, so that there is really something out there. And then all of a sudden, I graduated from, you know, let's say having faith in these things like we're taught in, you know, the Judeo-Christian tradition, mostly to have faith. And faith is another way of saying you haven't really seen this stuff for yourself, so believe what we're telling you. Well, now, you know, I felt like I went beyond that, and I graduated from faith to knowledge because knowledge derives from having a direct experience of something. I touched a source of information. I touched a higher intelligence, and that higher intelligence sent me some light, some information that allowed me to help other people. And it went on to other things. I mean, there were a lot of other, I guess, you know, you can use different terms for them, spiritual or psychic manifestations. Just started exploding and appearing in my life, and that was probably the beginning of my path, and I would say that laid the foundation maybe in my later life for me putting together a work like we have here in Pope Annalisa.
Well, and just to give you all a synopsis of what exactly Pope Annalisa is, it is the novel that Peter has written, and just to give you a little bit about what's going on in this fabulous book. Okay, a woman is a pope, for one thing. She's a black woman, and and she goes in and she just twists the world around Catholicism, Christianity, Gnosticism, paganism. Did I say Islam? all kinds of interesting things begin to show up in this book. I mean, it's just fantastic. I think... I would definitely say that Peter has he's gone beyond the mortal coil, and he's probably gone into some things that have happened in the past and has actually brought them forth as fiction. But you know, we can certainly, when you read this book, you're going to know that many of these things are things that he's actually tapped into, some information that he's pulled up from the annals of time, so to speak. But it's a beautiful book, and you've got to read it. I mean, he's solved all of the problems of the world, you know, in this book through this African Pope-esque, so to speak. And with that thought in mind, we all know many of the listeners. I know you're interested in the Tarot, and you're probably very familiar with it. But we know that the ancient medieval Tarot deck had the Popess. It was a feminine pope. Can you go into that story there?
Well, you know, the Tarot in the Middle Ages developed out of the suppression of Christian and Jewish mysticism that were the core of those religions. And just to take us back a little bit further so we can see the origins or antecedents of what you're talking about, there were two main branches of Christianity in the very early days after Christ, and that was the Gnostic and the Orthodox branches of Christianity. Now, there were many different Christian communities, and each had a different version of the Christian story itself, because there was a lot of variety back in those days. It wasn't like it became later on when it became the Catholic Church, and you've got to believe one way, and you've got to believe one story. But there were really two broad branches or streams of Christianity. Now, the Gnostics were the mystics. The Gnostics were those sages, Christian sages, and incidentally, the Gnostics, I should say to be accurate, Gnosticism was part of a universal spiritual tradition, and a very ancient tradition that ran through almost every major religion that has ever been and ever is on Earth right now. And
Peter, just for a little bit of information, would we kind of link that with the Sufis of Islam and maybe the Kabbalists of Judaism?
Absolutely. You could almost say that the Jewish Kabbalists, the Christian Gnostics, and the Islamic Sufis were essentially the same sages. They were the mystic core of their respective outer religions, and in fact, they probably had more in common with one another than they did with their outer religions, because as mystics, they basically experienced energy at the same dimensions when they went into their meditations, and they would bring information back about our origin, our purpose, and our destiny as human beings, and this information would correlate with one another, whether they were a Sufi or a Kabbalist. They were essentially bringing back the same information in different parts of the world at times when there wasn't the type of communication we had here now. So it wasn't like they were all sitting around in a room exchanging notes together, but
right.
the coincidence of their subjective visions that they had in their meditation were startlingly similar. And I often say that the prophets speak the heart of God, their followers start religions. Within each of these religions, it started with a mystical impulse from a prophet or prophets, which was very close to the source of this intelligence. But of course, then it had to get translated through people who had to take it on, there's that word, faith again, because they had not had the direct experience themselves that the prophets had had. So now we get into interpretations, and when you involve interpretations, you involve ego and personalities and agendas, and then before you know it, the mystical core that the religion started out, that the spiritual movement started out as, now becomes a religion. It becomes institutionalized. It starts to have creeds and dogmas and different formulas and so forth, and it becomes something substantially different from what the original mystic impulse was.
It really does. And in the book, you bring out where it begins to turn into politics. It begins to marry with, for domination and control and enforcement, so to speak.
Yeah, because the actual history. Incidentally, I should mention, this is not a Catholic book. This is not even really a Christian book per se. The title might be misleading in that regard. It uses the Catholic Church and the Judeo-Christian tradition as a vehicle to talk about issues and situations that are universal to all humanity, and about problems that are universal to all humanity, and a spiritual solution to those problems. And these traditions, because they're so common in the West, I use these as obvious vehicles. But it really speaks to almost everybody's situation at every time in every culture. And the actual history behind it was, we have gone through cycles in human history. At one time, the character of our spirituality and religions was very feminine in orientation. The Magna Mater, the Earth Goddess, the worship of Isis, these were really much more commonplace. We swung over completely to the opposite end of the spectrum. There's lots of reasons for that, which are too complex to go into now. But, for the past couple thousand years, it's been a very logical, linear, patriarchal domination that has dominated most of our religions and cultures. And I think what we're seeing now is a swing back, where I really so strongly feel, and I still so strongly felt during the writing of this book, the rising of a feminine energy that was coming back to rebalance our world. And by feminine energy, don't read that as the feminist movement, as a political movement, as equal pay and feminism and so forth. Those are maybe superficial manifestations of what I'm talking about. But what I'm really talking about is the fact that the very fabric of the universe itself, although we come from one energy, that one energy has multiple appearances, particularly in the physical world. And it primarily operates off of polarity, which the famous yin-yang, the polar opposite energies, which really kind of provide the heat and energy and motion of creation and of the physical creation. The ancients would have called these this yin yang male and female energies, and the male energy, as we said, it has very much to do with the mind, the logic, verbalization, logical or mind, you know, mind-based thinking, leading from the mind, whereas the feminine side is more intuitive, deals with feeling. It leads its actions from feeling rather than from mind, and it is more creative and more elliptical rather than linear in the way that it proceeds. And it's that energy that is coming back, I think, to rebalance this world that has been so tipped to one side, to help make us more balanced human beings. Because if we balance these right and left brain energies within us and we come to some kind of an operating symmetry where each of us finds our own internal balance between intuition and logic and these male and female qualities, as we become more balanced individuals, we also produce a more balanced world, a more harmonious world. And that was much of what Jesus used to say in the lost Gnostic Gospels that were discovered in Egypt in 1945. They have him saying throughout these Gospels, the two must become one. And he was saying this exactly, that these male and female energies must come to a balance at some point. And I think that's what we're starting to see now. And the fact that you see so much literature coming out on the figure of Mary Magdalene, well, Mary Magdalene is an archetype for the rise of this feminine energy. And I think you'll be seeing even more. I mean, it's much in my trilogy, Mary Magdalene plays a major role. She was treated a little bit differently in the Da Vinci Code, but nonetheless, she's in there. And this is not, in my mind, coincidence. When I started this project out 10 years ago and I was doodling around with this whole thing, you never heard anything about Mary Magdalene. And now, I mean, it's almost everything you pick up, you can find her somewhere, because she is an archetype for the movement and it's a movement within our psyches and our souls of this energy coming back into balance.
Right. And, you know, as you alluded to about that female pope, you know, when we go back to that, of course, a lot of the mysteries had to go underground.
Right.
Because things got so frightening and scary for anyone who had any kind of a belief system that was different from the Catholic Church at the time, that this female pope was actually, you know, again, just reiterate for us, this was information that was hidden, and exactly what was that information to be revealed later?
Well, it's there was, if we go back and we examine the Bible, mm-hmm. there are many passages in the Bible where it says that Jesus taught one public teaching to the masses, which he taught in parables, and to the disciples in private he gave the mysteries.
Yeah.
That situation was also reflected in some writings of the early church fathers, which are not really played up by the church, obviously, anymore. But, for instance, you have Clement of Alexandria, who wrote that after St. Mark, who was the secretary to St. Peter, after Peter was crucified in Rome, Mark came from Rome to Alexandria in possession of a number of secret gospels, which contained the secret teachings of Jesus that were only to be given to the elect, or the elect meaning those who are spiritually mature enough to receive them. The original structure of Christianity, and this particularly comes out in the Gnostic Gospels, is there were two parts to Christianity. One was to be the outer church, which was the church of the parables, the church for the masses, the church to at least get people on the road to a spiritual path. And then there was the inner church, which was the Gnostic church, which was the church that was designed to take those who were ready, who were the real seekers and were really ready to receive the mysteries of spirit and basically the divine picture. That was almost like graduate school. So it was originally intended that the outer or Orthodox church was to be sort of like spirituality 101, and then at some point, when the consciousness of the particular person would be ready, they would go on to the inner mysteries. But unfortunately, the way it evolved was the outer church ended up destroying the inner church, because it got to the point where the outer church became so dogmatic that it could not tolerate anything that didn't toe the party line, because now you had a whole hierarchical structure of, in the priesthood and the bishops and everything else, and it had such vested interest in it that they really couldn't really tolerate anybody that wasn't essentially saying what they were saying. So they destroyed their own inner mystical core, their inner church, which really was almost like, you know, I guess the only thing I can liken it to is like committing seppuku. It's like taking a sword and cutting out your own gut. They really cut out
yeah.
the heart. soul. They really cut out the heart and soul of their own religion, and they were left with an almost near-empty shell.
Very, very true. Now, what is it? What's the significance of choosing an African female pope as the main character of your book?
Yeah, let's talk about Africa and Nigeria for a second. There were a couple different reasons. I chose Africa as a venue, and I chose a female African pope. Oh, for one thing, I lived in Nigeria for a number of years. So I was very well-versed with the people and the customs, and it was obviously familiar to me, so it would make for a more realistic backdrop. And I think about the first third of the book takes place in Africa.
Right.
And Nigeria is also the most populous country in Africa. It's a country that is almost evenly divided between Islam and Christianity. The north is Islamic, the south is Christian. And the country has always been kind of a flashpoint or a front line between the tensions that typify the different world outlooks of those two religions. There's almost always, we don't get as much news about it over here, but they're constantly having clashes, religious clashes over there. And since this whole great dynamic between the West and the Islamic world today, you know, which we're all confronting and trying to figure out how to deal with right now, since this forms so much of the background and the plot line of the book, Nigeria seemed a very good place to, you know, to have as a venue for the book. As far as the female pope is concerned. Well, as far as the female pope is concerned, it's exactly what we talked about. She really represents the rise of the feminine energy. She represents the new world rising and the old world crumbling, in effect. And what could be more typical than that when you see a woman breaking into an institution that has been strictly male for 2,000 years?
Right.
So that was I think a very you know pointed way to tell a story of the greater energies or mysticism that was going on behind the you know the scenes of the plot line itself. And finally, as far as Annalisa as an African woman, I think another key issue in the story was that Africa is still a place where you find animist religion, where you find natural religion that is not really Christian or Muslim, but it really grew out of the earth. It grew out of the nature and the surroundings of the African people, and it's much less encumbered. It's a much more direct experience with those energetic forces than all the obstacles the Catholic Church has, and not just the Catholic Church, but other organized religions have placed between us and the divine. The various dogmas, the rituals, the hierarchies, all those filters that we have to go through supposedly to reach the divine through our institutional religions are all absent in these natural religions. It's a direct experience. And much of the message in this book, if you could say, you know, what was I really trying to convey to the readers of my book, it's probably that each of us is capable of having a direct experience with this divine energy. It could take the form of, well, my story that I told you and what happened to me. It could take other forms. But everybody, in my belief, is capable of having a direct experience of the divine without all these intermediaries that essentially say, you know, I've got the answer. Stop at my bus station instead of going down the road and experiencing your spiritual growth as a progression. So you're going from one point to another point to another point along the road. So if anything, you could say that this book is a signpost to help launch people on that direction of their spiritual journey, but it also cautions you to never mistake the signpost for the destination. Traditional religions would, you know, really encourage you to mistake the signpost for the destination. Like, here's my bus stop, cash your ticket in here and stay here, and I'll tell you how it is. That's in their interest to do that, you know, and that's something that I think is limiting.
It really is. And the character, Annalisa, I mean, she's the perfect, the absolute perfect culmination of all three. I mean, her mother was Muslim. You know,
yes.
from the northern provinces, she was Fulani, and her father, you know, was the Christian, mm-hmm. and then She was raised, of course, by the village shaman as well, and also by the Catholic nun. So she had this blending
yes.
of all of it. And she came through it with the essence of it all. And that's what she brought forth when she, you know, when she was able to heal, which was, I don't want to give too much about the book, but just to give a little teaser, you know, she had the ability to heal. And that's what got her into the position as Pope. And then
she walks in two worlds, as you're pointing out. And the book, and it really kind of reflects the book. The book, in a way, is really two stories. It's a
yeah.
thriller that talks about this miracle-working nun in a near-future world where resources of oil and water are scarce, Iran's gone nuclear, frictions between the great powers are about to boil over into potential nuclear war. And then you have Annalisa acting outside the control of the church, performing these healings, upsetting both the church hierarchy and Muslims, because some Muslims are converting because of her healings. And she's like this wild card that appears on the world geopolitical scene here in Nigeria. But then the other part of the story is the part that explores this lost spiritual tradition that was once prevalent among ancient Christians and Jews, this universal spiritual wisdom, which really stressed intuition to balance logic, heart to balance mind, experience to balance faith, and opposed a very different view of the role of human beings as in the evolutionary process, not just of our human evolution, but in the evolution of our entire planet, our entire world of Earth. It poses a very, very different view of humans and a more empowering view of humans, because this tradition says, and here's probably the key distinction when I talk about this mystic wisdom tradition, I can't get into one overarching definition probably in the limited time we have, but the one attribute that I could say about it that really makes it different from what our outer religions have been teaching us is that the human being is actually a projection of God's own spiritual essence. That means that humans are expressions of the infinite in finite form, here on Earth for the purpose of evolving consciousness, God's consciousness, into matter. We're like the fingers of God that touches the experience of material creation, and we bring that experience back into the divine realm. Now, that
yeah.
is a much more exalted view of the human being than what we're told in
indeed.
Our Western religions. Yeah,
indeed.
Because, I mean, think about it for a second.
Nothing is wrong.
Right. Think about what Western religions tell us. They tell us that we were like lumps of clay. God breathed life into us, wound us up like little dolls, and now we're bouncing off the walls of an earthly insane asylum. And by the way, we spend most of our life trying to get over original sin, which is basically the sin of being born because some mythical ancestors supposedly sinned against God, and now we have to pay penance for it. So, I mean,
exactly.
It's a very different picture of humanity.
It really, really is. And then let me just reiterate this, that there's nothing wrong, you know? It's all an experience. And I think you bring that forth so beautifully, you know? Even all of the animosity that's going on, the struggles that are going on. I mean, my God, this woman, everyone on the globe, whether it was in Tehran or they were in Germany or in the Vatican, they were in Nigeria or if they were in the United States, they wanted her out of here.
Mm-hmm. She was upsetting the apple cart, yeah.
She certainly was. But I just admonish everybody, you must get this book. You can actually get it here on the show page. Just click on it and you'll be able to purchase it right there from Amazon. It is just an awesome read. But it's also just the first book. You have the First Souls trilogy, and this is just one. Tell us about that.
Yeah, the First Souls trilogy is about the first souls to incarnate into material experience from the higher dimensions. So it really traces their incarnated lives over different epochs of human history. And the story of the first souls from the beginning of the mists of time all the way up to the present is really an allegory for the whole story of the origin and destiny of humanity and you know, where we have come from and, you know, what are we evolving to or what are we evolving into.
Mm-hmm. And I love the way you illustrated that, the characters connected with one another, and they were able to see where, that initial beginning of their spark. She actually led them in a vision to see that. And so this trilogy just carries them through what? We're going to go back in time, or we're going to go forward in those from this Annalisa book?
Well, a little bit of each. The second book is called The 13th Disciple. The 13th Disciple is Mary Magdalene. And the second book actually takes place both back in the biblical times, talks about some of the origins or previous lives of the first souls, but it also cuts into the present time with the characters from the first book from Pope Annalisa. It continues on with the story of their lives, but it alternates with lives experienced back in biblical times, cutting back and forth.
Mm-hmm. Oh, it's going to be absolutely fascinating. I know that I am am going to be one of the first ones to get the next addition to this First Souls trilogy. So I would just love to have everyone know. I knew we have a few people who've just joined us in. We're peeking with our Peter Canova, who's the author of Pope Annalisa. Fascinating novel. And there's actually a website for you to get a little bit more information about this book. You can just Google it. Just Google Pope Annalisa, and it'll take you right to the website, and you'll get a bit more background about Peter and his work and what brought him to this. I'm just really excited about it. You know, when I first picked up the book, I said, oh, okay, this will be kind of like the Da Vinci Code.
A lot of people think that, yeah.
Was I wrong?
Yeah.
So much more. I mean, certainly the Da Vinci Code, I mean, Dan Brown did a great job of opening it up, you know, which, of course, it sprung from many other books, but he was the one that kind of brought it to the masses, so to speak, so that people could begin to question and delve into, you know, mm-hmm. move beyond what they've been taught.
Dan Brown did tap into that vein of people who were really curious or kind of thirsting for an alternate story to what we've been brought up to believe about our spirituality and our spiritual legacy. Of course, I wouldn't really call it very much of a spiritual book. Dan's main theme in the Da Vinci Code was the old bloodline theory, which is that Mary Magdalene and Jesus were married and had children. And Mary was pictured in his book as the Holy Grail, or the receptacle of Jesus' children. Now, Mary plays a very important role in the trilogy that I have, and she's also the Holy Grail in a sense, but not as the receptacle of Jesus' children, but as the receptacle of Jesus' secret teachings, the Gnosis, that she was the one who passed this on. And incidentally, this isn't fantasy. This is pretty well spelled out in the Gnostic Gospels, which are the ones that we mentioned that were found in Egypt in 1945, which is the testament of the poor, destroyed Gnostics, or the mystical branch of Christianity. And Mary had an exalted role. She was shown to be the lead disciple, much more so than Peter was. Peter, in fact, was pictured as a kind of dense guy who didn't really get it, and he didn't really understand.
He didn't get it.
No, he didn't. Peter was really coming from more of an Orthodox Jewish background, and his understandings of Jesus' teachings were always constrained by that fact, whereas Mary had none of those constraints. She had none of those inhibitions, and she so clearly understood his teachings that she was almost like she was a co-teacher, in effect, because the questions that she would ask of the disciples when they were together and the teachings were being taught helped Jesus essentially clarify his own teachings to make them more understandable to the other disciples. That's how keen her perception was of what he was saying. And many of the Gnostics, in fact, thought that she was the yin-yang complement to Jesus. She was the female counterpart of the Christ energy.
Balance.
Yeah, she was the Holy Spirit, in effect. She was the incarnated Holy Spirit, who was the female counterpart to the incarnated male Christ energy.
Great. Well, you know, Peter did. He did fulfill his mission in this book, and I don't want to spill the beans on who Peter is in Pope Annalisa, but He did make up for his mistakes in the past. He did in a wonderful way, and I love the way that you did that.
There was a reconciliation that took place at different levels, yes.
So let's go a little further into that. I mean, I really love this subject matter, but, you know, of course, there was I think it might have been in the 70s. I'm kind of dating myself, too. But Peter, Paul, and Mary. Now, we know about Mary, and we know about what Peter did, but how did Paul get in the mix?
Okay, I assume by Peter, Paul, and Mary, you're referring to St. Paul. You're not referring to the pop group. Because when I think of Peter, Paul, and Mary, I think of the trio that I used to see back in the 70s in different music halls. Yeah,
exactly. But we know where they kind of mix that in with that as well. But, you know, Paul, I mean, how did he get his big toe? He wasn't even around at the time.
Yeah, Paul's an interesting character, and there is a lot of controversy, and there are so many different views around Paul, several different, you know, things that I've read. Paul was really interesting. I probably vacillated on him more than any other biblical character, because in some ways, if you look at Paul's writings, you almost see elements of Gnostic teaching in there. And yet, by the same token, though, he was the architect of the Orthodox Church.
Yeah.
In many ways, and that's why I think that sometimes I see, you know, in fact, it's really funny because I read that even back in ancient times, some of the Gnostics used to claim Paul as sort of one of their own, while their counterparts, the Orthodox Church Fathers, were claiming Paul as one of their own. So he's always had this kind of split decision on Paul's role. You know, was he really more of a mystic, or was he, you know, really the guy who was more responsible for the hierarchic or institutional church? And I think that he may have been a person who had an understanding. Because remember, the way that Paul came into Christianity was not the way the other disciples did. The other disciples had direct contact with Jesus. Paul didn't.
Exactly.
But Paul did have this striking vision on the road to Damascus.
On the road to Damascus. Mm-hmm.
And that vision, in which, you know, there was a lot of light and everything involved, was rather interesting because it sounded in some ways like a Gnostic experience, like an enlightening experience that some people have, some mystics have had over the ages, and that's how it came into Christianity. And I think there was a good chance, and I really haven't meditated on this question too much, but I will one day. I think there was a good chance that Paul probably had some mystic awareness, yet somehow he felt that he had to be a bridge or play a role to bring a larger group of people into the Christian fold. And so, therefore, he probably went more over to the Orthodox side. And unfortunately, it looked like in history that the Orthodox and their mystical counterparts, at least from the Orthodox side, couldn't find a way to coexist. The Orthodox couldn't really tolerate the mystics. The mystics had no problem with the Orthodox. They considered the outer church, like I said, spirituality 101, and that was the stepping stone to maybe, you know, a higher awareness of the inner church and the mystic teachings. The Orthodox just could not seem to tolerate the mystics, and ended up literally physically and psychically eradicating them. And I think maybe if that was Paul's plan to try and keep a little bit of a mystic core in the teachings, yet play to the wider Orthodox Church, it might not have worked out so well, because the Orthodox really did a number of the mystics.
Mm-hmm. Now, in your view, I mean, I've often contemplated this whole thing about, because we know the Vatican is there in Rome.
Yeah.
Now, we
have
the Roman Empire, right? And then all of a sudden here we have the Roman Catholic Church.
Mm-hmm.
Now, there's a blending there. You know, it's also a political statute there. So, in your opinion, you know, was there an evolution from the Roman Empire into the Roman Catholic Church?
Well, yeah, there was a marriage there, and mm-hmm. The two partners in that marriage adopted major aspects of each other's personas. What happened was that as the Orthodox started to prevail over the Gnostics, it was the desire of the Orthodox Church Fathers and the hierarchy to become the state religion of the Roman Empire. And since there was such a strong female leadership in the early church, and yet it was still a patriarchal world, it became an embarrassment to have so many female leaders. So the female leaders were pushed out of the church and written out of the Gospels. In fact, some people have made a very good case that the Gospel of John is actually one of the Gospels of Mary Magdalene. The name was changed and the whole thing was redacted, and that the beloved disciple in the Bible was actually Mary Magdalene and not John, and again, that was, you know, redacted out of the Bible. But there clearly seems to be strong circumstantial evidence that there was a conscious movement to push the females out of the church to become more acceptable to Rome. Apparently they succeeded because around 321 to 325, during the time of Emperor Constantine, was presiding over an empire that was starting to fragment, and he was looking for ways to reunify the empire. One of the ways he saw was, you know, if we have a common religion and a common creed, then that is a tool that can be politically used to keep the empire united. So he basically got these male bishops in a room and kind of almost like with a gun to their head said, okay, you know, formulate a creed for us. And, you know, we came up with many of the dogmas and creeds that are still in practice in the church today, and they had to be essentially run through, you know, Constantine for approval. So, yes, there very much was a marriage of politics and religion involved, and that was a conscious effort, I think, on both the part of the elements of the Christian Church and of the Roman Empire itself.
Certainly. Well, I just have to see, I'm seeing everyone is just so quiet there tonight in the chat room and in the phone line. We've got listeners and we've got people who've joined us here.
You mean I managed to put everybody to sleep?
Everybody's so quiet. Well, I think what's happened is that they're just so mesmerized, you know. It's like you are pulling up truths that everybody has already sensed within themselves, and so we're all trying to get comfortable with that. But I would invite everybody that this is a really great time to call in if you have a question, or if you're too shy to call in, just type it in the chat room. If you have a question for our guest, Peter Canova, the author of Annalisa, Pope Annalisa. We have just 15 minutes remaining, and so if you guys are too shy, or maybe we've answered all the questions, I'll just keep going because I have a million questions. And so... while we're waiting for that, if somebody wants to ask something, I will get another good question in. You know, it's fascinating that you bring out a lot of scientific information, you know, about the mysteries of the universe and vibration and all. It seems that the ancient mystics certainly had a wisdom of modern science. Would you speak to that a bit?
Yeah, it's startling. The Gnostics and the ancient mystics were probably the great scientists and psychologists of their age. But the funny thing is, they didn't use the scientific method to arrive at their information or solutions. The mystics would essentially, through various means, penetrate the realms of this higher information or the higher dimensions. And they would bring back information from there. And, you know, it's very difficult if you have ever done this before. When you go into these realms and you bring back information, sometimes it's difficult to verbalize. And certainly what they brought back was so complex that people, especially back then, probably would never have understood it in its pure form. So they would essentially formulate myths in order to convey the information. Now, myth should not be taken as something that is just totally fantastic and the figment of imagination. Imagination doesn't mean fantasy. Imagination and fantasy are two different things. Fantasy is something that really doesn't have a basis in it. Imagination is a tool which you can use to penetrate psychic energies and bring back information. And they brought back information that, if you want to put it in modern terms today, I'll give you a couple examples how the ancients might have characterized it and what modern science says today. The ancients said matter is a gross, crystallized form of higher energy. It's energy vibrating at such a low level that it essentially crystallizes into something that seems solid. This is exactly what Einstein's relativity says. E equals mc squared. Matter and energy are interchangeable. The other thing they said was that our universe was emanated or projected from a series of pre-existing universes or pre-existing spiritual realms. This is what the current parallel universe theory says, that we live side by side with other dimensions and that our dimension proceeded from other dimensions. In fact, it was even more specifically, modern string theory postulates that the universe, our universe, three-dimensional universe, was a contraction of 10 or more dimensions. Well, that's exactly what the mystics said, that there were 10 or more dimensions and that the material dimension was expelled from those dimensions because they couldn't coexist, almost verbatim. There are the famous hermetic saying, as it is above, so it is below. Well, that was the ancients' way of describing fractals and holographic universe theory, where each part reflects or contains a portion of the whole. So if you look at the most microscopic part, it actually contains a story about the whole part, because we live in a hologrammatic universe. So, you know, they didn't have the tools and they didn't have the technical terms 2,000 or 3,000 years ago. But if you make adjustments for that fact, what they were saying and the information they brought back from their divine, you know, penetrations or mystical experiences predated our most modern quantum physical and scientific theories by thousands of years.
Incredible. So that just, right there for me, my logical brain, my linear side says, that's proof.
Well, you think of it, Tom. Yeah, you're right. Think of it for a second. We probably come the closest to the truth that we probably come is when our inner subjective experience is validated or intersects with the scientifically gained experience by objective experimental techniques. And when science and the mystical subjective experience start to intersect and say the same things, perhaps that's the closest thing that we come to truth that we can know.
I would say so. I would definitely say so. Well, this is just absolutely fascinating. So when can we expect the next edition to this First Souls trilogy?
As soon as all your readers buy the first book.
Okay, you know, everybody, click away.
Hint,
you can
hint,
get
hint, hint.
Right, well, here on the page.
Yeah, you know, it's really funny because marketing the first book is a full-time job. I will tell you, I'm up at,
sure,
you know, 6 or 7 in the morning, and I don't stop until like 9 o'clock at night in the promotion of the first book. It's probably the closest I'll ever come to an understanding of what it's like for a woman to give childbirth is to birth a new book. And there's lots of pains involved. And it's kind of taken away from my time that, you know, to complete the second book. So I should mention at this juncture that the book in its hardcover version, the publication date is June 1st, so it's coming up on us. However, I think it already should be available through most bookstores by ordering, because it should be on the computer databases now. Yeah, good.
It's
well, then
right
hope
here. Uh-huh.
Good. Hopefully, we'll be on the shelves by the summer. A lot of that all depends on the consumer response to the book. If the more people that buy the book, the more likely it is to appear and stay in the shelves. So, you know, I would encourage you guys, if you have an interest in it, that you can really help the project out by trying to pick up the first copy of Pope Annalise, and I think it'll be a rewarding read for you. And like I say, I think by the summer you should start seeing it appearing on shelves of the different major bookstores.
Well, I have to attest to it. As I said at the onset of the show, that I read this book. I mean, and it's a thick novel. I mean, it's, what is that? That's 400 plus, nearly 500 pages, and I read it.
Yeah, about 450 pages, yeah.
Yeah. I read it nonstop. It's riveting. It's very relevant. It touches the core of your being. I mean, it touched me on every level, you know, because it speaks to everything. I mean, Annalisa went in, and she tore it all down, you know, and you weren't sure if she was evil or if she was good, but you know what? You didn't care.
Yeah, well, Annalisa is a complex character, and you're absolutely right. Throughout most of the book, you really don't know what her agenda is. It's obviously, when she comes on the scene, the world goes to hell in a handbasket, and you don't know if she is going to be the savior or is she the creator of this harsh new world. And think about it for a second. When Jesus was conducting his ministry in Palestine, a whole segment of the population, they thought he was a sorcerer performing
they
all
did.
all these tricks and everything else. Certainly that was the position of the Pharisees and the high priest. Then you had another part of the population saying this guy is a genuine healer. He's come to enlighten us. So I think there's always, all great figures are never black and white, and nothing in this world is really black and white. We're creatures of light and we're creatures of shadow simultaneously, and it's really a question of how those forces interplay within us that to a large part determines our personalities, our direction, and really the direction of the world itself. And I think that that's honestly reflected in the character of Annalisa. So she is a complex character. She's not a one-dimensional character.
She's not. And I think you really bring it home, the fact that, again, I'll say it again, and I'm really believing this, that nothing is wrong, that even the most evil, I think from one of the lines in the book where she talks about how evil is just a very crooked path to good. Yeah. I mean, to paraphrase you, I mean, I know you know that line because you wrote it, but it's basically that everything serves in some way, you know, everything.
The whole concept of good and evil is very interesting because I have really sensed, and I think I've had this validated in independent readings, that this whole business of light and shadow is not just a human condition, but it probably extends even into the spiritual world. Because when the ancients believed that God, or that, let's say, you know, whatever you feel comfortable with, God, the higher intelligence, the supreme being, when God projected its energy outward into successive manifestations, it was almost like, think of it, okay, the best way to describe it is, when you make a copy or you make successive copies of a DVD or CD, each individual copy that's further from the original has a little bit less information, a little bit less clarity, okay? So lack of information, a little bit less information means ignorance. It's the same thing as saying ignorance. So each projection away from the center or source of being was a little bit more in shadow, was a little bit more ignorant of the source until finally we get to the lowest level, which is material existence, where we have probably the most foggy understanding of where we've come from. And that means that the shadow is much greater in this dimension because we are that much more ignorant. So our real purpose in life, one of our purposes, is clearly to work with this interplay of light and shadow, you know, within ourselves, and work through that and work our way back to the source, which is the source of light. So ultimately, it is good. The tone of the universe is a good tone. The principle of the supreme being is good, and it is light. It's only as we move away from that shadow sort of starts to appear, and it's really kind of illusory, because at the end of the day, as you said in the book, and as Annalisa says many times, even evil dances to the tune of God.
Oh, yes, indeed. Well, I thank you so much for joining us, Peter. I hope to have you on again soon. I know that this book is going to get a lot of attention, and it's going to break down some barriers. It's going to get some people thinking, you know, and I know that's definitely part of the roles of great literature, you know,
to get some
thoughts moving.
Yeah, thank you. Well, look, I should mention, I mean, fortunately, I think some of that recognition is starting. I'm pleased to tell the listeners that within the last couple of weeks, Pope Annalisa has won two major book awards. It won the Nautilus Award for Visionary Fiction, and it won the Independent Publishers Award, which is the largest book award in the world. There were 4,000 entrants, and these were the first two book contests the book was entered in, and it's now two for two. And hopefully there'll be some other things like that in the future. And, you know, I think that the significance of that just is, to me, the significance is it's not even so much like a source of pride, but a source of satisfaction in the sense that people are picking up on the message in the book and bringing it to heart. And it really does have a heartfelt impact on everybody that reads it. And the thing that an author probably longs for most is to make an emotional connection with his or her readers, and the book seems to be doing that, as is evidenced by, you know, how it swept these awards. So I hope that anybody listening tonight that does pick up the book, that's exactly the type of experience that you will have.
Oh, most definitely. Well, I thank you so much, Peter, for joining us. I thank all of the listeners, everyone who's calling in. You all are so silent tonight. I think they're just blown away, Peter. They're all just sitting there listening and taking it all in.
I hope it's that, not that they're snoring.
Oh, no, they're not snoring. Trust me. My listeners are very, very in tune people. They're always studying. And I think you've given them some food for thought, some things that they may not have heard or considered before, and I think that's what's happening here. But I thank everyone for joining us. Thank you, family. I thank all the callers who've joined us. I thank everyone who's listening at some future time through the podcast, because we're podcast everywhere as well, 24/7. But peace and blessings to everyone, and thank you once again for joining us here on Illuminations Radio.